We just have a few guidelines to make this Q&A as efficiently and as enjoyable as possible. I'm sure we will get a lot of people who wants to who would like to ask questions, some questions. So I'd ask you two things. First one is not to take more than 1 minute to make your comments or ask your question. Please avoid long introductions. Time is short and we want as many of you to be able to ask a question. And second, well, all questions are welcome, even challenging one, but we'd like to ask you to be respectful to the speaker and to the audience so that it's we have all a pleasant session. We'll ask people to line up, maybe to make two lines we have here on the right, and we could have a line over here as well. So please don't be shy, come down.
When you say how it is affecting us, what in particular do you mean?
The whole everything you just said about Israel and Palestine and all of that.
Just give me one moment. I have to think that that's my mind is too tired and I won't know. Okay. We're going to take 3 questions at a time. Go ahead. Oh, you're second? Okay.
I want to hear your opinion on the possibility of having a one-state solution, taking into consideration the current situation with the settlements. That's happening.
You made reference to international law. Okay, I just wanted you to stipulate which law you were referring to regarding the fact that not only should Hamas not receive weapons, but Israel as well.
Okay, the first question was a general question, how does this conflict affect us? Here I'm going to have to answer more specifically in the American context, about which I'm more knowledgeable. I referred to the Amnesty International report during my remarks, the report entitled Fueling Conflict. And Amnesty International makes 3 statements. Number one, it says, as everybody in this room knows, that the US is the chief arms supplier for Israel by a wide margin. Number two, it says that the transfer of weapons to Israel is illegal under international and domestic U.S. law. Number three, which is in many ways the most fateful comment, Amnesty says, if you don't like what happened in Gaza, bear in mind it could not have happened, and I'm quoting them verbatim, were it not for U.S. taxpayer money. But it was U.S. taxpayer money, their phrase, that allowed for what happened in Gaza to happen. Let me give you one simple example. The white phosphorus shells that were used in Gaza, the human rights organizations found the shells. Every single white phosphorus shell in Gaza was made in the United States, was manufactured in the US. So at the most basic level, the US and US taxpayer money it enabled the Gaza massacre. There is a second question which is of some interest. When you ask, how does it affect us? There is a kind of implicit question, which is, of all the conflicts in the world and all the troubles and suffering in the world, how did it come to pass that the Palestine conflict has so seized the imagination, in particular of young people, such that although I don't know this campus, I could say with almost certainty that no other conflict in the world would draw out a crowd like this on a Saturday night. Why is that? Well, Israel and its supporters have an obvious answer. That is because you all hate Jews. That is anti-Semitism. That's the main motivator of those who are dedicated or invested in the conflict. My own impression, for whatever it's worth, is that it's just not true that it's anti-Semitism for a basic reason, which is most people who get involved in the conflict, they get involved because of their feeling of identity with those who are suffering, and Israel is the afterthought. It's not like they go to the West Bank because they hate Israel or hate Jews, but rather they go to the West Bank, see what's happening, and then feel a great deal of anger at those who are causing the people to suffer. That's been my impression, but I can't obviously prove it. As to why Palestine and not elsewhere, it is a complicated question. Unless somebody else asks the question of why I think people focus on Palestine and not, say, India or a thousand other places in the world's map. If somebody wants me to answer that, I'll look at it. The second question is about one state and whether or not the settlements, the illegal Jewish settlements, have in fact closed off the possibility of a two-state settlement. That too is an involved question, but let me just give you some parts of an answer. Number one, there is a good deal of misapprehension or misunderstanding about the actual scope of the settlement process. The settlements themselves occupy less than 1% of the West Bank. Physically, they occupy less than 1% of the West Bank. Number two, a large number of settlers, they went to live there not for ideological reasons, but because of cheap subsidized, state-subsidized housing. And according to some polls, 60% of the settlers say that if they're given compensation by their government, they will move back to within the Green Line, within Israel proper. Number three, it is possible to have what are called, in the technical jargon, minor and mutual border adjustments. Israel keep 1% or 2% of the West Bank, and Palestinians in return get 1 or 2% of Israeli land, of equal quality land, say adjoining Gaza, which is a very densely populated area. So that's another possibility. It's true there are fanatical Jewish settlers of whom it would be difficult to get them to leave voluntarily. But even that is a vastly exaggerated claim. So let's take the most notable of these fanatical settlers, the 400 or so Meshuggah Jews in Hebron, crazy Jews in Hebron. A lot of them come from my neighborhood in Brooklyn, New York. You've met them, yes, they're crazy, for sure. You know, they have this look, this glazed look in their eyes. For those of you who remember that film from the 1950s, the Stepford Wives, they all look like the Stepford Wives after the women are killed. But they happen to live in Hebron. And anyone who knows Hebron, a lot of crazy Muslims there, very stubborn. Muslims from Hebron are known to be very stubborn. The joke is, did you hear the story about the Muslim from Hebron who fell off a 12-story building and nothing happened to him? 12-story building and nothing happened to him. Why? He landed on his head. Those are the Hebronites. So, all you have to do is tell those 400 settlers, hey guys and gals, you want to stay in Hebron, the 400 of you, surrounded by 170,000 Muslim Hebronites? Stay. But our army is leaving. So you will be alone among them. And if they're given that option, I know my fellow Brooklynites, in the blink of an eye, there will not be one settler left in Hebron. And to be honest, if there's one left, I don't think he or she will be alive very long after what they did, what those settlers did in Hebron, which is so terrible. So I don't think the obstacles to trying to resolve the conflict are yet or have yet reached an insurmountable stage. On the third question of the international law, and in particular the person asked on the issue of the arms and the transfer of weapons to a consistent violator of human rights, I would recommend to that person just look at the fueling conflict, the Amnesty report, and they go through all of the law very carefully. The other point, which is in my opinion more important, is that on all of what are called the most controversial issues of the Israel-Palestine conflict, Jerusalem, borders, refugees, and settlements, on all of those crucial issues that are called the final status issues, the International Court of Justice ruled on all four of them in July 2004, and they issued an advisory opinion. They said, number one, all of the West Bank and all of Gaza are occupied Palestinian territories, and they are the unit designated for Palestinian self-determination. Israel has no right, no title to 1 inch of the West Bank or Gaza. Number two, they said, East Jerusalem is occupied Palestinian territory. It is not Israel's eternal capital. It's not part of Israel's undivided capital. It is not a controversial or disputable question. They said very explicitly, East Jerusalem is occupied Palestinian territory. Number three, on the question of the settlements, they said, there can be no question that the settlements violate Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. They are illegal under international law. And the main human rights organizations, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, in 2000 and 2001, they issued position papers in the right of return, and they both said, Amnesty and HRW, Human Rights Watch, they both said there can be no question that the Palestinian refugees and succeeding generations that have maintained genuine links with the land, that they have a right of return under international law. So the reasonable conclusion is that if even on the most controversial questions, there's no controversy whatsoever, there's really no obstacle to resolving the conflict except for Israel, backed by the United States, their refusal to respect the most elementary and uncontroversial principles of international law. Okay, three people from this side.
Thank you, Professor Finkelstein, for being here tonight and lighting our night. I have very quick questions. I will take advantage of you being here so that I ask you very technical questions. The first question is basically you're the perfect person to answer it because it's related to your PhD dissertation, which is, do you think that the ideology of Zionism is in somehow any different than any racist ideology that emerged in the 20th or 19th century, for example, like fascism in Italy or Nazism in Germany? Is it any different? Because I see it, my opinion, I see it equally, that certain people have rights and privileges that other people don't have. The second question, 3 months ago, the former Prime Minister of Spain, José María Aznar, said a very controversial statement I try to understand. He said, if Israel collapses, we, the West, will collapse. I would like to understand, since you're a renowned academic on this subject, why he thinks so. My third and very most question is that, do you think the two-state solution is a very good solution? I think it's not a good solution, because thinking about the nature of the state of Israel, any agreement that will forge will not survive. Because say, I am married to an Israeli, I'm a Palestinian, married to an Israeli woman, we are fighting over a child. If my wife called the Prime Minister of Israel, the day after they would invade the whole country. So my country will be removed from the face of the earth. So I think with the nature of a country called Israel, I think two-state solution would not be possible at all. Thank you very much.
Yeah, but because of the number of people and the fact that I feel my mind is beginning to die on me, let's try to limit it to one question per person, if you don't mind.
Okay. I have a question about, you mentioned a couple of times in the past that you want to speak to the UN General Assembly. Has that happened yet, or are you still trying to organize that, and when would we expect you to speak to the UN General Assembly? Thank you.
No, the one needs you, so I hope you keep the hope. I was saying that when the Israelis attacked Gaza, they produced a lot of Palestinian and friends because the stories are told to the doctor who lost the children and so many. But the main question is, I find that now a lot of Israelis are coming to live in Canada. They now call Toronto, Tel Aviv, and Ottawa, Jerusalem. Prime Minister is now almost like an Israeli. The CDC is the voice of Israel or voice of Likud. So I was wondering, what should we? Don't you think we should welcome them and then work on Canada as a state of Israel as a solution to Canada-Palestine solution?
Because
Canada is a land of Israel settlement in addition to the indigenous settlement.
What did he say? I didn't hear the question.
I'm saying that should we not welcome these Israelis to live in Canada like you do in the United States and let them be educated like we did with the colonizers in South Africa and some of the killers, they're still here and some of them are even the president of the university. So I was just wondering, because that seems to be the more feasible solution. The Russians here, the Israelis are now calling themselves Russian Canadians. The French, the Israelis from France are calling themselves French Canadians, and hallelujah. They're having the Tea Party.
Okay. The first question, I'm going to take two parts of it together, namely on the feasibility of the desirability of the two-state solution and the question of Zionism. And I'm going to be kind of blunt here. I recognize, because I met the gentleman who asked me the question before I began speaking, and I'm sure in terms of our hearts and our souls and our moralities, we're in the same place. But sometimes heart, soul, and morality can be in the same place where politics is not. And I want to clarify what my political point of view is, because not that my political point of view in and of itself is of, should be of any special interest to anyone here, but because it has to do with how I think we can win and why I think sometimes we're inflicting wounds on ourselves and we lose when we can win. I personally don't see any point whatsoever in debating, arguing about whether or not you are now or have ever been a Zionist. I don't see these as useful kinds of arguments. If you want to call yourself a Zionist, so far as I'm concerned, I couldn't care less. The issue is not whether or not you're a Zionist. The issue is where you stand on basic issues of human rights, where you stand on the basic issues of the conflict. Do you or do you not support demolition of people's homes? Do you or do you not support ethnic cleansing? Do you or do you not support settlement construction in the occupied territories? Do you or do you not support a full Israeli withdrawal from the territories it occupied in June 1967? Those, to me, are the relevant questions. Everything else is a kind of sectarian indulgence. Because, let's be clear, I think we should be clear that our goal is to try to reach a broad public. And why should we create obstacles to trying to reach that public? So some people say, but we have to talk about Zionism. All right. Richard Goldstone, he calls himself a Zionist. He says, my mother was an activist in the Zionist movement. My daughter did Aliyah, emigrate to Israel. I was on the board of directors of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He says, I devoted most of my adult life, a lot of my adult life, to Israel. But on the other hand, Mr. Netanyahu gave a speech after the Goldstone report was issued, and Netanyahu said, Israel faces three great dangers. Three great dangers. Number three from the bottom, he said, was the missiles and rockets from Lebanon and Gaza. Number one, the biggest danger is Iran. And between them, number two, he said the second biggest danger facing Israel, he said one word, Goldstone. Now, Goldstone says he's a Zionist. If you're going to exclude Richard Goldstone and his type from our ranks, then we might as well just give up. We should all go over to a little ashram, hold hands, and chant Om from now to eternity, because the struggle is hopeless. Professor Chomsky, if you ask him, he says, I've been a Zionist since I was 6 years old. That's Professor Chomsky. When I was 6 years old, I was learning how to zipper my pants. But Professor Chomsky, at six, he read everything on Zionism, and he decided that he was a Zionist. There's a funny little story about Chomsky, which I always like. It's told in one of the biographies of him. He's sitting on a sofa. His legs barely are below the seat, let alone reaching the ground. And behind him, a woman comes into the living room and says, oh, little gnome, I noticed behind you, you got a new Funk and Wagnalls encyclopedia, 40 volumes. So what do you think of that encyclopedia? And little gnome, 6 years old, he turns to the woman, he says, I'm not sure, I've only read the first 15 volumes. Now, I want Noam Chomsky in our corner, because it's a very depressing thought to think he's
the enemy, leaving aside the mind, there's also the indefatigable energy. But if you start setting up litmus tests like, you can't be in our movement unless you're a Zionist, we've lost him as well. We lose Chomsky, we lose Goldstone. What do we have? I don't see the point of that. And I don't even see the need for it. The basic issues are issues of human rights and international law. The Palestinians have a very powerful card in their corner. It's called the law. And Israel is terrified of that law. It keeps saying now, if you follow the Israelis, they say we have a new enemy. It's called lawfare, L-A-W-F-A-R-E. It's warfare, they say, but warfare using the law. Lawfare. Mr. Kotler, he has a lot to say about lawfare. And so that's our card, the law. And so long as people are willing to enforce the law, I think that's sufficient for them to be with us and enable us to win rather than to lose. On the question of the speaking before the UN General Assembly, I squandered several months working with Arab delegations. And the immortal words of Meir Kahane, for those of you who remember him, never again. I'm not going to waste time on that front. The Arab League, the Arab leaders, it's all a talking shop. It has nothing to do whatsoever with trying to achieve any kind of justice. As somebody said, the people in the Mavi Marmara did more for the people of Palestine in one day than the Arab League has done in 60 years. And I think that's true. As to the third question about whether or not Canadians should welcome Israelis, I think they should in there. Yeah, because Canada is a very nice place. People here are very nice. Okay, the government's a little weird. The people are nice. So I think you should preserve your tradition of welcoming everybody, because that's what makes Canada such a nice place. I remember when I started coming here in the early 80s, and I met Palestinian refugees in Toronto, and they would say to me, you know, a refugee's life is not a good one, but if there's any place in the world I would want to be a refugee, it's Canada. So it's to your credit. It's to your credit. And it's certainly a tradition which, were I a Canadian, I would be deeply proud of and want to continue.
Just please allow me just a moment. Before we continue with the Q&A, we would like to provide you an opportunity to support the work of CJPME through becoming a member or just donating to support the continuation of our work. So if I can ask now our volunteers to pass out the membership cards, I really encourage you to support our work. Please consider doing so. When you're supporting or making a donation, please put a check mark on the envelope so that we know that this is a donation from you. Thank you very much.
Okay.
You stated earlier that you all have to be reasonable. Being reasonable is almost like beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Then you basically mentioned the issues in the answer and to some of the questions. You talked about the West Bank, occupation of the West Bank, the settlements, East Jerusalem, and the refugees. So in all of these cases the occupation is illegal, yes, there is some areas in which you can figure out the settlement issue, Jerusalem is occupied legally, and the refugees have the right to return, okay? Under international law. Now, if you do that, and if you accept all of these things, the problem is that it goes against what seems to be the international consensus in which of a two-state solution. Because if the refugees are allowed to return,
Would you please ask your question? Thank you so much.
How do you move the international consensus from being an international consensus to an international consensus that's based upon international law?
My question is, how do you talk to Middle America? How do you talk to the people who believe that they should support Israel unconditionally because it says in the Bible that the Jews will go back and the Messiah will come again? And frankly, there's a lot of people out there in Canada and the USA who think that. And those are not the choir. Those are the people who I would like to reach out to. So how do I reach out to those people?
Hello, Professor. Thank you very much for being here. What do you my question is, what do you think, what is your opinion about Iran's support for Hamas in order to improve Palestinian people's lives? Because I'm Iranian, and I've been very concerned with the Palestinian issue. I've been following it up, and very much on the humanitarian side of it, and always observing the injustice that's going on. But, you know, the Iranian regime, I think, is just oppressing its own people and trying to support other regimes which are not really helping for its own. I don't know really what it's trying to do, and I'd like to ask you whether it is really influential. Because, you know, on the streets of Iran, people are saying, no Gaza, no Lebanon. I live my life for Iran. Because 31 years, the government was like, for other people's, fighting for other countries' causes, which was right, but, you know, but the people were ignored. So I just want to see if you think it makes sense, really.
Just add one point. You are 70 Iranians here, and you don't stay in your So I think it's her view, and it's not our view.
That's a fair question.
Yeah.
So
okay. No, I think it's fair to say a significant number of Iranians say it and a significant number don't say it. It's one of those issues that divide a society. That's a fair statement, and we should look at it. On the first issue, the first question, I think the person said, to put it in its essence, he said, I talked about trying to be reasonable. And he said, well, reasonable would seem to mean supporting the law. But he said, if you actually support all of the law, then if all the refugees return, which is their right under the law, then one of the aspects of international law, namely Israel's right to be there as a state, that aspect will come into question because the refugees will return and Israel will turn into no longer a state with a predominant Jewish population. So he says, doesn't the law come into conflict with one tenet of the law, namely a two-state settlement? Okay? So what do I mean then? First of all, I often see and have actually attended conferences where I hear Palestinians say, until every last one of those 7 million refugees returns to Israel, this conflict will not be solved. All 7 million. And so they conjure up this image of Mongol hordes descending upon Israel. Now, 7 million Palestinians do not want to return to Israel. That kind of rhetoric is just designed to prevent any possible resolution of the conflict. The actual number who want to return, judging by polls and all sorts of other things, is very significantly less. The main population, plainly, is the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. And even their number is now probably, officially they say 400,000, but in reality, because probably about half their population has quietly emigrated to Europe, so it's probably about 200,000 refugees now. Judging from Lebanon fairly frequently, I talk to people about the actual numbers, it's probably around 200,000. What does reasonable mean? Number one, don't needlessly create these kinds of scenarios which will make a resolution impossible, because you want to show how politically pure you are. Number two, no, I do not believe the Palestinians should forfeit that right of return. My best friend in the occupied territories is a fellow named Musa Abu Heshesh from Fawar camp near Hebron or Al-Khalil. And we talk about the refugee question. He said, look, I am very conservative on the refugee question. And he tells me about the suffering of his family, of his father. He shows me where they grew up. And I am not going to ever in public or in private say that he has to forfeit that right. But then there are different ways to realize a right. Now, I'll make a comparison. I am not comparing suffering. I am simply comparing principles, not suffering. I lost my job at DePaul University, my tenure track job. My lawyer, brilliant lawyer, wonderful lawyer, she said to me, look, if you want, you can get your right to return. Because the law is clearly on your side, DePaul does not have a case. If you want, you can win back your right to return. But she said, realistically speaking, it's going to take like 6 years, because that's how long it takes to arbitrate tenure cases. She said, you have to make a decision. Do you want to devote the next 6 years of your life to fighting for your right to return? Or would you prefer to take a settlement? I thought about it. I said, I'm getting older. I don't really want to sit day in and day out, reliving the nightmare of that 10-year year, writing these dossiers and briefs, because effectively I'm going to do all the writing because I know the case. And I have more important things I want to do with my life. So I said there, okay, I know I have a right to return, and I know I could win it in court, but I'd rather go for a settlement. And if I can get the settlement, I'll just move on. So what were the terms of the settlement? Number one, that DePaul had to acknowledge that what it did to me was wrong. I am not going to accept that my record is going to be blighted. And at the end, DePaul issued a statement which said that Finkelstein was an outstanding teacher and a prolific scholar, which of course raises the obvious question, well, if he was an outstanding teacher and prolific scholar, why was he denied tenure? And then, of course, there was a financial component to the settlement, because I'm unemployed for life, that's a fact. I cannot get it ever again, a job again, not only in academia, but anywhere, because of what was done to me during that last year. And you can make the same offer to Palestinians. I don't know what they're going to say, but you can make the offer. There has to be an acknowledgement by Israel of the historic wrong that was inflicted on the people of Palestine. If you don't acknowledge it, same thing with me. To DePaul, you don't acknowledge it, we're going to court. I am not going to let that pass. There has to be a public acknowledgement, And then there has to be a financial component to a settlement, and maybe it can be worked out. I've asked, you know, I asked my friend Musa, okay, what do you want? What do you want? He said, present us with a package. Show us what you're offering us. Don't tell us that to begin negotiations we have to give up the right of return. Forget that. But you can say, we're offering you this, we're offering you that, we're offering you this, we're offering you that, and then see whether people are willing to accept it. My impression is purely personal, can't prove it. Palestinians are perfectly reasonable. If you're reasonable with the Palestinians, you can reach a reasonable resolution of the conflict. And that's what I mean by reasonable. But I'm not going to tell anyone what to do. And they say no, okay, and they're back to the fight, you know. But I'm not going to preclude the possibility that if they're offered a reasonable settlement, the Palestinians will accept it, and we can move on. How do you speak to Middle America? How do you speak to people who believe that the land was given to the Jews, and that the Jews are going to come back, and then there's going to be rapture, and we're all going to go up to heaven, and I don't know what. I can't follow all of it. I don't really care. It's not my cup of tea. Part of it is you try. You use elementary reason. You say to someone, you say that because in the Bible it says that this land belongs to the Jews, that they have the right to the land. So you say to the person, well, let's see how that works. If I come knocking on your door and I pull out my Bible and I say, according to my Bible, my people originated where you're living now 3,000 years ago. So your house belongs to me. Would you give me your house? Would they do it? A significant number, I can't judge how many, will be convinced by the logic that the Bible has its place, but as somebody once said, it's not a real estate deed. So it doesn't belong here. And then it's true that some people can't be convinced. It's true. There was a famous Russian revolutionist named Leon Trotsky. Some of you may have heard of him. And in the 1930s, he was once asked, what are we supposed to do with fascists? And Trotsky replied, acquaint them with the pavement, if you get the drift. I guess you don't, because you're so polite in Canada. He says you have to use force against them. There are some people you can't convince, it's true. But it's also true that public opinion polls now show a lot of people are becoming very critical of Israeli policy. So I say let's focus on trying to galvanize those who are ready to be convinced and not expend what probably is useless energy trying to convince those who will never be convinced. On the third question of Iran, which sparked a little controversy in the audience, Mr. Ahmadinejad, first of all, we should be clear about Iran's record. The record is very clear. From 2003, if you look at the UN General Assembly, Iran has every single year, including this past year, the Islamic Republic of Iran has voted together with the rest of the international community supporting the two-state settlement in the June 67 border. That's their record. The only ones who aren't supporting it are Israel, the United States, and a few South Pacific islands. But Iran is with the rest of the international community. Iran is a member of the 57 member strong Organization of the Islamic Conference, the OIC. In 2002, the Arab League called for the two-state settlement and the June 67 border, a just resolution of the refugee question. The OIC, the Organization of the Islamic Conference, unanimously endorsed the the Arab League Peace Initiative. Iran is a member of the OIC. So their record on paper is not bad. On the question of, you know, it is a fact and you can't deny it, as the woman said, but she was not happy with that. But the fact is that all destruction of Israel wreaked on Lebanon in 2006. It was basically Iran that enabled the people of Lebanon, the Shia population, because the destruction was targeted, to rebuild. I can't in good conscience condemn that. I can understand you saying we want the money for ourselves. But, you know, my attitude has always been, I'll speak personally, question of taxes. We pay a lot of taxes in the United States. Not as much as you do, but we pay taxes. My attitude always is, I'm willing to pay more taxes so long as I know it's going for a good cause. I don't want to pay taxes for weapons. I don't have kids, but if I heard my taxes were being raised for schools, I'm not going to criticize that. If I heard my taxes were being raised for libraries, even though I do most of my work through a university library, not public libraries, I'm not going to criticize that. So I can't really feel a common sentiment with those who criticize the government of Iran for helping the poor people of Lebanon rebuild their lives and enabling them to live in a home with a roof over their heads. I can't do that. Mr. Ahmadinejad is not my cup of tea. I do not like him because I think he's a demagogue. Well, I'm not sure if the estimates are about $100 million went to rebuilding Lebanon. $100 million is not all the money in Iran. It's money, but and I'm not trying to put you down. Believe me, I'm not. But I can't be hard on the government for doing that. If you were to ask me, how do I feel about torturing political prisoners? We'd have no disagreement. Killing demonstrators, we'd have no disagreement. But rebuilding people's homes, no. I can't get angry about that. It's just not me. You know? Okay, I think let's try wrapping up. We'll take four questions from here, and we're done.
I was just going to ask you about your opinion on the recent elections in Europe of kind of ethnocentric parties, so kind of anti-Islamic, and also the fresh debate on whether they should ban some types of clothing that are Islamic, because they, you know, basically have sold the Islamic headdresses. And it also concerns the fact that only 5% of the population of the EU is Muslim, so it seems kind of overkill. And just one thing, speaking to that gentleman who talked about reaching middle America, I'm from Alberta, I'm from Buck Lake, Alberta, and my grandparents were creatists. And one thing you shouldn't do is ridicule them and consider them stupid or hillbillies, that'll never work. And you should always try to appeal to them, as you said, also appeal to the children, people like me. Because it's probably just through your family and to really attack the family personally. It's easy to attack someone who's on top instead with racial epithets, but it's hard to attack your own family members when they attend people. And taxes are the price of civilization.
I should have said that. You know, I'm going to just cut you off. Yeah, I think that's right. You know, the kind of elitism, which is particularly pernicious and pronounced in people on the left, liberals, the Harvard liberal types, who look with so much contempt on middle America. I find that really contemptible myself, and we should not lose sight of the fact that those sorts of folks, the ones with all the degrees, and all of their knowledge are the ones who cause so much death and destruction in this world, far more than anybody in Middle America ever could imagine doing.
How do you define terrorism, and can it be morally justified?
About what?
The silence in the Arab world on the governmental level regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And what are your suggestions for what can we do as citizens of the Arab world to try and get things to move along on the political level?
You mentioned earlier how in a certain couple of reports that possibly or almost definitely, a future war with Lebanon would be instigated by Israel. But also in the event of that war, Israel would refuse defeat, especially in its current political situation. Mm-hmm. With that in mind, if it really does escalate into an armed conflict beyond Lebanon and Israel, which Iran, Turkey, maybe even the United States is involved, do you see, at least in the immediate future, a decade or so, that this conflict would be resolved? And wouldn't that be by violent means rather than peaceful, which could possibly just build up more tension, more resentment for years to come?
Okay. The first question was the growing anti-Muslim sentiment in Europe. And we'd have to, of course, add now the United States, where things are, for the first time I have to acknowledge, are actually getting quite ugly on the question of the Muslims. The person asked about the banning of, in France, the hijab, the burqa. I'm not great fan of Barack Obama. By far, I'm not. I think he's wretched. But he did say one thing in Cairo, the only thing in Cairo which I thought was pretty good in that speech. He said it's nobody's business if Muslim women want to wear the hijab. And I thought that was a very good statement by him, and one which definitely deserves support. You know, mind your own business. And let people live as they want. And if they wear it because of parental pressure, social pressure, well, we all do all sorts of things because of parental pressure and social pressure. You know, I see a lot of women wearing these high-heeled shoes, which they can barely walk in. They must do terrible things to their feet. And they do that because of social pressure. And I don't see any government banning high-heeled shoes because they have sympathy with women. And everybody knows, people like Sarkozy, they're the sleaziest, slimiest, smarmiest, sexist pig scum. Does anyone possibly believe they care about women? No. It's so wretchedly hypocritical and demagogic, especially now by people like Angela Merkel in Germany, whose ratings are dropping. So she comes out and says that multiculturalism has been a failure, you know, just for electoral reasons. Complete creep. And then the guy from Germany, Sarrazin, who's starting now, there are Jewish genes. A lot of Jews like that idea, because we all know we are smarter. But also attacking the Muslims, you know. My attitude to the Germans is, you don't want Muslims? Then have children! Because the only reason there are Muslims in Germany is because the Germans didn't want to have kids. That's right, they need somebody to work. So, The Germans took, and I'll admit it, I'm saying it, somebody who doesn't have children, it's a purely selfish decision. You don't want to give up any of your career and squander it on kids. Okay, you made that decision. And then you have nobody to work in Germany. So then you brought in the Turks to work because your population wasn't reproducing itself. Well, that's a fact. So if you don't want Muslims, then go have kids. But then don't bring them in to do all the hard labor and then tell them they have no rights. The only reason Germany's still there is because the Turks have been doing the work since the 1970s. And now you're saying they have no rights? No. Unacceptable. What is terrorism? Well, you know, terrorism is not such a complicated idea. It's targeting civilians to achieve political ends. That's what Israel did in Gaza. It targeted civilians to achieve a political end. It wanted to restore its deterrence capacity, the Arab world's fear of it. It's a political end. So they targeted civilians. They even have, as I said, they coined a term for their terrorism. They call it the Gaza Doctrine. Targeting civilians and civilian infrastructure with massive force in order to achieve a political doctrine. I don't think there's any problem with what is terrorism. The problem is that it's only used against the weaker side. But if we apply the term across the board, then it's clear that if, you know, if Palestinians are terrorists or Hezbollah are terrorists, then they are retail terrorists. And the governments against whom they are battling, they are wholesale terrorists. That's the only difference. Actually, I was on a Russian TV program. The Russians are the only ones that let me on TV. It's true. Only Crosstalk. I don't know if any of you see it, but only Crosstalk will let me. It's the only country in the world that will let me on. Many, many years ago, I was on CBC, but that was a complete flop. They never let me on again. It's actually a funny story. They asked me on one of these programs where we had debate, and they said to me, I said to them, when you have the show, should you wait your turn or should you interject? So the woman said to me, interject. Be aggressive. Okay, you told me, be aggressive. Well, at the end of the program, I thought I was great. I was aggressive. I went up to her and I said, so how was I fishing for a compliment? She said, you were horrible. I said, horrible? She said, you were horrible. You were so aggressive. I said, you told me to be aggressive. Never tell somebody from Brooklyn to be aggressive. Especially in Canada. Okay. Well, anyhow, I was on Russian TV and I was debating this person. And I said the same thing about wholesale terrorism, retail. She says, what is this wholesale resale? We're not in the garment district. It was a good line. I had to give him credit even though I couldn't stand it. On the question of the Arab regimes, you know, it's very hard for me in the United States to lecture other people about what they should do and the kinds of sacrifices they should make. Okay, I paid a little price. I lost my job. I spoke my mind. I lost my job. Okay. But in most of the countries in the world from which many of you come from, in the Arab and Muslim world, if you speak your mind, you don't lose your job. It's not true. You don't lose your job. You lose a body part. You lose your ear, you lose your tongue, you lose your nose, you lose your genitalia, you lose your head, you lose your life. That's what happens in most parts of the world, the Muslim Arab world. So who am I to tell them or lecture anyone about what they should be doing? It's a very difficult thing there, and I know that. It's a very hard struggle. And the consequences are literally, they are lethal if you speak your mind. So I'm not going to give any advice. The problem is not that, well, there is some problem, to be honest. There is some problem in places like Egypt where people have been completely depoliticized. maybe it's from despair, but large numbers of people have really bought into the consumer culture and lost interest in politics. But there are also parts of the world where people do care, but the consequences are so fateful that I'm not going to lecture them and I'm not going to wag my finger. I live a too privileged life to tell others how to conduct themselves in that regard. And the last question was on, I have it, I can't actually read what I wrote. What was the last question? The war in the, yeah. I'll be honest about that. I've thought it through a lot. I can see it beginning, because you already see the talk beginning. So now, every once in a while, you read a news report about Syria training Hezbollah and sending weapons to Lebanon, because all of the documents I've read say that once Lebanon is attacked, they're immediately going to attack Syria. So they're preparing the ground now in the media for the attack on Syria. And yesterday, the past couple of days, there have been really quite disastrous developments in Lebanon. The Special Tribunal on Lebanon, what's called the STL. I'm going to just give you what I've read. I don't know where the truth lies. But Syed Nasrallah, he gave a speech yesterday, in which he said that the Special Tribunal investigators, they invaded a women's clinic in the Dahya and demanded records in the clinic, apparently records on 17 women. And Nasrallah was outraged, and he immediately gave a speech, and he said, now they've gone too far, because they were soliciting the gynecological records of the women. And he said, he called on all Lebanese no longer to cooperate with the STL, the Special Tribunal on Lebanon, on Hariri's death, Rafiq Hariri's death. Now the report yesterday was that Ban Ki-moon, the corpse, he's the Secretary General of the United Nations, he doubles as a corpse. Ban Ki-moon condemned Nasrallah, and then a large number of the factions, including Hariri, the Hariri's son, Saad, he condemned the Hezbollah. And it looks like it's starting, and it's going to be a big problem, because they're going to use now, of course, the Americans came out supporting the government of Lebanon and the whole thing. And then they may pit the whole UN machinery against the Hezbollah. And so it's looking grim and very worrisome. So to answer the question, it's easy to envisage it starting, but try as I may, I can't figure out how it's going to end. And I don't want to think about how it's going to end, because it could be horrible. It's really terrible where things are going. Nasrallah's calculation, and with all due respect to him, because he's a very smart guy, I think his calculation is incorrect. He said over and over again that the Israelis will not start a war because they will not take significant civilian casualties. So long as they know that in the event of a war, they will have to suffer significant civilian casualties, they won't launch the war. But I think that's an incorrect assumption, because I think Israel, the leadership, wants significant civilian casualties, because it's very isolated now internationally after what it did in Lebanon, then Gaza, then the Mavi Marmara. And the only way it could justify annihilating Lebanon is by broadcasting all over the world these massive civilian casualties. So I think he's wrong. I think they actually want them. The leadership, not the people, but the leadership wants them as a alibi to annihilate Lebanon. So I think his calculation is wrong there. On the other hand, there are many hands here. It's also true to say that regardless, leaving aside the prospect of a war, there is a possibility that Lebanon again will quite soon descend into civil war, and people are very nervous about that over there. Actually, if you talk to people, they're more nervous about the prospect of a civil war right now than of an Israeli attack. And if there is a civil war, it's perfectly obvious what's going to happen. The U.S. and Israel will just sit back and let them kill each other, and whichever side is losing, Israel and the U.S. will support it. They may even end up supporting the Hezbollah, just like they did during the Iraq-Iran war. And whichever side seems to be, then is the winner, seems to be winning, they'll support the other side until they all kill each other. And that's a possibility. It may happen. But whichever way you look at it, it's a very painful sight to behold.
I have a quick question, which was similar to the last Chinese question. It's about if Israel decides to attack Lebanon and then get out of control, Iran will probably, like you said, will take a part of that war. And if Iran decides to take a part
you have to speak louder because I can't hear.
Sorry. If Iran decides to take a part of that war, I would assume, I don't know what you think, but do you think there will be a third world war? And also, will the Arab world take part on either side, and who will it be?
Thank you, Dr. Fintan, for being here and sharing your time with us. Shortly after the release of the Goldstone Report at the University of Victoria, not far from here, you spoke with encouraging words regarding the potential that report held. Given the time that's elapsed, I was wondering if you could comment on how you feel the potential of that report has been realized, if at all. And I would very much appreciate a second answer, brief though it may be. As an Indian, I receive that question often, why Palestine? I'm quite well versed in the issues within India, such as Kashmir, and I was wondering what your response would be to why this particular issue as opposed to others. And you mentioned India, so with particular reference to Kashmir. Thank you.
My question is, what do you say to controversial theorists who claim that Hamas is funded by Israel because Hamas's actions indirectly benefit Israel and gives them the excuse to attack Palestinians? And one of the examples they make is that Palestine Gaza is able to be supplied by rockets while it's in a blockade.
Hi. Shortly after the events of the Freedom Flotilla, I read that Israel had dispatched a nuclear-capable submarine to the Gulf of Persia in order for deterrence towards Iran. And I was hoping if you could tell me what something like that would entail, and if you could give some comments on the nuclear capabilities of Israel.
Okay, we'll try to do this expeditiously because we're all expired collectively here, which won't do much for the cause, a mass funeral. On the Arab world, well, it's clear that there is a fairly significant division in the Arab world. There were a large number of countries that wanted to see Hezbollah defeated in 2006. There's no secret about that. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, they were hoping, and others, by the way, Bahrain, they were hoping.
Can't hear you.
Yeah, excuse me. Give me 1 second. It's possible I disconnected it. Okay. Oh, I see, it fell off. Okay. There are a large number of Arab countries which wanted to see the Hezbollah defeated in 2006. And there was no secret about that. Nasrallah, in his own diplomatic way, said that we know Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, and several other countries were hoping that Hezbollah would be defeated, and they will hope in the next round that Hezbollah will be defeated. So there's no reason to be hopeful or optimistic about a collective intervention by, say, the Arab League. Second question, it's the first person that's asked it in all my time. He said that I was optimistic about the Goldstone Report, and do I still have that optimism? The answer is yes and no. As a legal issue, it's dead, but we should be clear about why it died. There is no question whatsoever about why the Goldstone Report died. It died because the Palestinian Authority killed it. They had multiple opportunities in the Human Rights Council to move in a resolution for the Goldstone Report's recommendation that Israel and Hamas be taken before the International Criminal Court. And each time the Palestinian Authority said, we will postpone decisions on this for another 3 months, another 3 months, another 5 months. And they did it again about 2 months ago. They postponed any decision and they killed the Goldstone Report. It was the so-called Palestinian leadership, which killed the Goldstone Report. It had a potential. That's why all this talk now about whether the Palestinians will declare a state, go to the United Nations, declare, it's complete nonsense. The Palestinian leadership is on the payroll of the United States and on the payroll of Israel. And if the U.S. and Israel say, you're not going to the U.N., they are not going to the U.N. Just as the U.S. and Israel told them, you will not press the issue of the Goldstone Report, it was killed. On the other hand, the Goldstone Report still presents major problems for Israelis who try to travel abroad because of what's called universal jurisdiction. And countries like the UK, Spain, and elsewhere have laws on their books that you can prosecute war criminals who commit crimes elsewhere in the world. And till this day, you know, Tzipi Livni, she keeps saying, I'm going to go back to the UK and let them arrest me. Well, my feeling is, go back. As a matter of fact, if you go back, I will campaign for the restoration of capital punishment. Personally, if you go back. But, of course, she's not going back because the Goldstone Report did galvanize a lot of the public opinion to pursue the legal route. Now, it died in the UN because of the Palestinian so-called leadership, but it's still alive in terms of things like universal jurisdiction. The third question somebody pressed me to answer or propose, why do people focus on Palestine? And this is an interesting question. If for a moment we leave aside the usual answer because of anti-Semitism, dislike of Jews, hatred of Jews, then what is the reason? Why is it that so many young people who are not Muslim, who are not Arab, a lot of whom happen to be Jewish, have been seized by the cause of Palestine? And I think there are several reasons. I don't pretend to have the answer. I think one reason is that Palestine is kind of a throwback to another stage of European colonialism and European imperialism, that era in which indigenous populations were dispossessed, displaced, expelled. And a lot of Western opinion, public opinion, has been sensitized to that particular kind of injustice. Of course, we've been sensitized to it because for most of us, it's literally a dead issue. The indigenous populations are dead. They're gone. They've been expelled and killed off. So we have the sensitivity that it's wrong. But among ourselves, there's no real action to be taken. But Palestine, it's that old kind of European imperialism and colonialism, which still is alive and to which people are sensitized in ways that they aren't sensitized to other kinds of injustice. Number two, Palestine has that same strange quality where you actually feel like you can have an impact. It's so small that you go there and you think that you actually count for something in the struggle. If it were somewhere like India, you know, you just plunged into a billion people, what can you really do? But Palestine feels small enough that it's actually manageable, tractable. You can actually hold it and you can actually do something. Thirdly, it's kind of like people say, it has that David and Goliath quality to it. An advanced Western country with the most modern weaponry in the world against basically a defenseless population. And there's that kind of simplicity of David and Goliath, which enables everybody, even those lacking a degree in rocket science, to see that it's wrong. And finally, there is the fact that elsewhere, take places like India, you have horrific poverty. But there isn't a clear sense of how you overcome it. There was a time when people believed socialism, communism, that's the way you overcome it. But nowadays, there's a recognition of a problem, but there's no clear sense of a solution. What do you do? Whereas in the case of Palestine, it seems like it's fairly clear what has to be done. This occupation has to end. And that's much more uncomplicated than trying to figure out how to abolish poverty in India. There are other things. I mean, you may ask, okay, then why aren't people focusing on rape in Liberia? I don't have a simple answer to that. But that's the most I can say. I don't think Hamas is... It's true Hamas, when it was originally founded, it was supported by Israel, you know, in the mid to late 1980s. In order to be a counterweight to the Palestine Liberation Organization. But it's no longer true now. I mean, that's just pure conspiracy theory. Hamas is not an agent of, directly or indirectly, of Israel. I don't see any evidence of that. And the final question is, those two nuclear submarines that Israel sent into the Straits of Hormuz, and the whole nuclear weapons issue. And my basic attitude is, I'm speaking personally now again, I focus on what I think I can do. I cannot focus on nuclear apocalypse, because then it's over. There's really nothing to talk about. And there's no point in expending energy on that. Of course, as a principle, you would want Israel to sign on to the weapons of mass destruction free zone in the Middle East, which of course is the most sensible resolution of the whole problem, that every country in the Middle East be forced to rid itself of those weapons. And we should struggle for that. If you're talking to me about something imminent, like whether those nuclear armed submarines are going to be used in the next few months, there's it's nothing to talk about. Because if it happens, it's just over. And there'll be no point to us even being here. So we should just hope for the best and that it won't happen. Now we have two orders of business with the last remnant, the hearty Bolsheviks who have stayed till the end. So I have to draw a card, two cards. And then I'm going to violate protocol because it's my last day of this trip and I'm going to take one prerogative, which Patricia is terrified of what I'm going to do. No, I'm not going to self-implode. Okay. The first winner is, I can't make out the whole name, it's A-C-H-M-A-N-I-N-E. Okay.
It's
Farhad. It's Farhad here. At this point, you're going to have trouble finding someone who's here. Second one is unfair. The person just put down Hussein.
Oh.
So, but the person did put down his or her email address. Hussein Sher at yahoo.ca. Got it. Okay.
Let's continue.
The third person is Hiba Bahri.
Okay.
Well, maybe we should start easy. Is there anybody who wants a book? The fourth person is Aber Al Hari.
Hajri.
Okay. But no. This one we're going to get. I know this person. Awad bin Mahdi.
Oh, we should pick up some, here.
Oh, here?
Yeah, at the bottom.
You should
skip this guy.
Is he here?
Yeah.
Oh, we have one. Koshin Mohammed. Is he here?
Yeah.
Raise your hand. A couple of days ago, we were doing this, and one smart fellow, when nobody raised his hand, he said, "I'm it." But the organizer of the CJPME said, "Can you bring up some identification?" Okay, this one is easy. Sherry Dayuang. Yes! Okay.
Please join me.
Wait. Before we do it.
We want to thank you for your generosity and your time. And to all of you as well. But Dr. Finkelstein has a nice video. That's the first thing he showed us in Montreal, actually, when he arrived.
And I want you to sing along. We'll get it on tape. And I have a very wonderful Palestinian friend in Greece named Sana Kasa. I gave the lyrics. The lyrics are from the anthem of the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. And we applied it to Palestine.
Let's see this.
Something is so strong. Come on. So we have a celebrity
so strong.